Hey, G-Lo here. Welcome to a slightly different episode of What We Watch When We Drink. On June 4th, we hosted a Friday Night Live session on our YouTube channel where we were joined by Martin Yeager of Yeager Spirits and Andre Darlington, author of Booze and Vinyl, Booze Cruise, Gotham City Cocktails, and several other cocktail-centric books. During this session, Martin guided us through several of his very delicious spirits, and then we tried them in some cocktails. It was a super fun session, so we thought we'd share it as a podcast. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Audible, or wherever else you get your podcasts. We're also available on the blog at boozedancing.com. And if you have any questions or comments, be sure to email us at boozedancing@gmail.com. Let's get on with the show. Cheers.
Hey, we're live.
Boom! We are.
Boom. See, welcome to Friday Night Live, boys.
Turn the ignition and that starts the whole booze dancing.
You know what it is? You got to let out the choke. Wait, you gotta let out the choke.
Who's dancing?
A little too much choking.
Has a stick? I didn't realize that. I can't drive a stick.
Oh, yeah. Well, neither could I. I'm grinding the gears right here. We're grinding the gears, boys.
We're grinding the gears on another booze dancing TV night, aren't we?
We are.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? Hang on a second. Why don't you know what? Don't we have a thing? We got we got a little intro.
We do.
We got our thing.
You should roll the intro.
Let's do the intro thing.
Let's do that first. And then we'll talk about our guests. Hang on.
We're going to go to the band.
Welcome to the murder table.
Cheers.
Cheers.
No, cheers.
Sorry.
Sir.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Slunch.
A caipirinha.
Like Martinelli, as you said, with a kick.
We do a little swirl. Do a little twirl.
Or zat.
Or zat. Appetizer?
Appetizer.
Appetizer. That makes me sad, but you know what makes me happy? Whiskey.
Cacao.
Cacao. Cacao.
It's everything I thought it would be and less smelling.
Boys.
Never gets old, Mike.
It gets old. It gets moldy. But we still get old.
And we see the Stawisha. We had that last night.
I know. That was good. I think for the record, it's Orjat, right? Is that the one that I got right? Or did I get it wrong?
Yes. I think you got it right.
Okay. I got it right. Okay.
All
right.
Well, now we're one for one.
That's
or
good.
Or is it two for two? I'm not sure.
Speaking of exotic sounding things, we got some fun stuff tonight.
We do.
We are down the rabbit hole of liqueurs, we're gonna have some fun tonight. I think
it's Friday Night Live cocktails.
That's one of my favorite shows.
And we got some fun stuff here. It's spelled Geiger.
That's correct.
You'd think it'd be geyser.
You'd think it would.
You'd think, but no. No, it's Yeager.
We really need subtitles on this show.
That's okay. Yeah, we do. And we're going to have Mr. Yeager here.
We are. Martin Yeager from Yeager Spirits.
Yeager Spirits. And we're bringing back an old friend.
Who?
Mr. Darlington.
Mr. Darlington. We like him.
Our man with the books.
Yes.
With the boozy books.
Wow.
So he's going to tell us about his two, not one, not two. Most people write one book at a time. But not Andre.
He's a go-getter.
And most people have one drink at a time, but not us.
No.
Three.
We're tripping up.
And then we got three cocktails to go with it.
It's really a very special edition.
It is.
Booze Dancing TV.
It is. You know what? Just one thing. 911. Speed dial.
Keep it close, baby. Not 912. Yeah. 911.
Hey, should we ring him in?
We should bring him in.
Sure, why not?
All right, let's roll the intro and bring him in.
Let's do it.
They're probably...
Gentlemen, you guys have Mr. good Mayor. Intro. Wow, I feel like I'm on the Love Boat or something. Like special guests coming aboard. Hey.
Well, wait. You know what? Speaking of the Love Boat, we're gonna have to toast Captain Steubing.
Yes.
He's gone to the great cruise ship in the sky.
The great captain's table in the sky.
That's right.
There you go.
Hopefully, he doesn't get salmonella because you know what they don't clean very well in those things. It's horrible. Hopefully, there's hand sanitizer.
I hope he brought his Dramamine.
Yes. You know, he looked a little pale to begin with. How are we, guys?
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Thanks for coming on. This is awesome. We've got a little doubleheader here. We've got Andre and Martin, and we're going to talk all things spirits and travel and books and cocktails. It's a laundry list of stuff.
Yeah, it's a party. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and
absolutely.
If you're at home, well, you're watching already. But if you're not, tell your friends to jump on Booze Dancing TV's YouTube page or Facebook page, or go to the website boozedancing.com and hop in on the fun, and you can chat with us and come on in and talk to the guys about all things spirits and booze and cocktails and spirits and blah 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 blah. Correct?
Correct.
Oh yeah.
All right.
Why we're here, right?
That's why we are here.
Spreading the love, proselytizing good booze.
That's right. So we got two different stories here. We want to jump in on both, and we'll bounce around a little bit. We'll start, Martin. So you've got this little spirits company. Give us a little background on it. Yeah, give us a little background on it, and then maybe we'll try something from the little spirits company you got.
All right, sounds good. Well, you've already cleared up the name situation, the spelling and the pronunciation. So Yeager Spirits, or Yeager Glug Incorporated, as it actually is listed. So the spirit that started everything is the glug. Oh, yes. We got multiple bottle shots here.
Nice. So
when I started this company, it was because I moved to the U.S. from Sweden when I was just over 20. And my great grandmother, she had a moonshine still in the backyard and made her own glug. So she made it with the spirit base and used the traditional glug spices, which is the warming baking spices. And this is something we've been cooking at home with my family for four generations. So naturally, when I moved to the US, I brought the recipe with me and started cooking it over here. In the beginning, it was kind of hard because you got to go to Indian bazaars to find the cardamom and stuff like that. But, you know, it's easier now to get a hold of all the ingredients. So I started cooking it here as I did in Sweden and served it to my American friends. And it turned out they really liked the flavor of the glug. And so I decided that, hey, you know what? Maybe we can make a company out of this and share this with a wider audience. So that's really what started the spirit company, Yeager Glug, which now have morphed into Yeager Spirits, because once I got into the craft cocktail spirit scene, I got really hooked on these advanced flavors that I found out there. So I launched a slew of other products, and tonight we're going to try the Orange Liqueur and the Amaro as well, but I have a couple of other things like an Aqua Beat and a Fernet and even a Falernum. So very exotic, esoteric stuff. We want to start by tasting the glug, I think, sure, would be a good starting point, since that is the foundation of the company and the beginning and the roots of it.
Hey, Martin, where are you located? Where are you? Where's your base?
I am in San Francisco, and we're distilling it down in San Carlos, which is about 25 minutes south of the city.
No, how big is your operation? Didn't we hear that you're kind of like massive? You got like thousands of employees, right?
Look at all those miles behind him.
You were looking at the sole employee of the company. Yes.
Wow,
a one man show.
We started at the top with this interview here.
Yeah.
So I do everything from sourcing to bottling to warehousing to delivery to making the recipes it's a busy schedule, but it's a lot of fun.
I can imagine. You're really tired at the end of the day.
yes, and weekends, that's really when the work starts, right? When you smell this, go ahead.
I was going to say, I missed the date. How long, when did you become a company and start doing it publicly?
Okay, yeah, I didn't say that actually, so you didn't miss it.
Thank you.
I registered the company in 2012, and it took about 2 years to get all the permits to be able to do a spirit and actually have it launched. About 2014, I had the glug as a single SKU, and then I had that for about 5 years before I dove into the other spirits.
Great.
Yeah. And the glug.
Let me just add one thing. You are now part of the JVS family.
I am, and the Impex family as well.
And the Impex family, right. So we want to thank our friends at Impex and JVS for sending us samples, and so we could enjoy this tonight with you guys. So how is this glug different, or is it, from what you were making, what your grandmother made in Sweden?
Great-grandmother, even.
Great-grandmother.
No, so this is exactly the same.
Exactly
same
the
recipe.
Same. Wow.
Same process. Mm-hmm. We actually mimic how she makes the spirit at home. She used to boil the spices in water to extract the flavors, and then add the alcohol on top and the sugar. So basically what we're doing a heat maceration with all the spices outside of the still. And then we scoop out the spices, put them in the still, do a quick hot maceration, and then distill it to get the oils out and blend that back in to the outside maceration. So all the color in the bottle actually comes from that hot maceration outside of the still.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah.
So what all is in there? Is it a secret? Can we know some of the details? What's inside?
Well, can we guess? Can we play a little guess?
Oh, we can guess. Yes, let's guess.
Yes. A little guess. There's got to be some clove.
Oh, yeah.
There's six ingredients. Yeah. One down.
Well, cardamom.
Yes, two.
I'd go with maybe dried orange peel or orange peel in some way.
Bitter orange peel.
Bitter orange peel. Yep.
Yeah.
A little cinnamon? Cinnamon?
Cinnamon, yep.
All right. Nutmeg? Mike, come on, man.
We probably should stop there.
While you're ahead, almond and raisins is also in there.
Oh, all right. Raisins. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So some of that sweetness comes from the raisin.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, as well as the sugar.
Is that the traditional way to do it in Sweden with raisins and all that?
Absolutely. And then when you drink it in Sweden, traditionally, you actually heat it up and you drink it warm.
Okay.
And then depending on where in Sweden you're from, some people put extra almonds and raisins into the hot spirit and they drink it. And when they finish, they scoop it out and eat the almonds and raisins afterwards.
So you're a former bartender. How do you see this in cocktails, and how does that fit into the world?
It was really fun. I was actually playing with it today, and I made a margarita with it because under the assumption that it could use it because it has just enough sugar in it. You know, you can kind of replace having simple syrup and really replace Cointreau, and it was really fun. And then I made, I'm just screwing around. I made a Negroni with it, sort of a laddered Negroni, just adding, like a half ounce of Campari and then 3/4 of an ounce or an ounce of this, and that was really fun. So a glugoni.
Glugoni, yeah, I like it.
That does sound really good.
Yeah, I mean, I really found this fun and versatile and very unique.
That was never an intention when we launched it, right? We thought we were going to sell this to Swedish expats, and they were going to drink it heated up like Swedes do. But as soon as bartenders got their hands on it, they started playing around with it in bars, and it turns out it is a very versatile spirit.
It smells like Christmas.
It really does.
And coming from a Jewish guy, that sounds...
I was going to say, yeah.
It smells like Hanukkah.
It smells like Hanukkah, sort of.
So a lot of time when I talk about this, I say we substitute for sweet vermouths in classic cocktails. It's a good starting point because you get those spice notes in there to play around with the spirits. But today I thought we were going to do something a little different. So that's why the first cocktail is going to have the glug in it. And it's going to have a whiskey. This time it's going to be a Pinderen Legend that we're going to use. And we got to basically do a twist on the rusty nail. So it's a fairly simple recipe because I didn't want to go too extreme, especially if people want to try to mimic and do something at home. So it's simply 2 ounces of the Pinderen. It's 3/4 of an ounce of the glug stirred over rock in a rocks glass with an expressed lemon peel. That's it.
I made mine.
You're way ahead of me.
It's
all right.
Pre-made cocktail. Isn't that the way the world is now? Everything is like shit to you?
Take a little.
Well, I am still making mine.
I didn't want to make a big mess on camera. It's really embarrassing. Spill all over my keyboard.
You really are embarrassing.
I am embarrassing. I don't need to spill everywhere and make a big.
I'm right there with you. My thumbs are barely opposable.
Hey, Martin,
I couldn't make one.
You guys are smart. I should have pre-batched them as well, huh?
Nice. That's a good ice cube there, Ange.
By another San Francisco guy. What's it? Camper English?
Yeah. Isn't he
Camper? Oh, yeah.
Camper is the man of ice.
So do you do the lemon after you stir, or do you put this? Do you do the
I, yes. So first I stir the cocktail, then I'm gonna pour it in the glass, and then I express the lemon peel and put it into the cocktail. So you get some of that oils on top of the cocktail. Perfect.
Angela's got it.
Look at that. This might be the noisiest episode we've ever had.
and
oh, wait. Next one's going to be shaken.
I got it. We got you.
Jingle.
You got your little marmalade jar for a shaker. It's always good fun.
Yeah.
Nothing
goes
to waste.
I actually froze my glass. I'm going to get my glass out of the freezer.
Look at him. He's got a freezer nearby. I have a washing machine.
Oh, yeah.
I think he was in the booze business.
It's like he's prepared or something.
He's a pro.
And we got that.
Look at that. And she got the big spoon.
Damn right I do. And thanks to Mrs. Satellite Engineer, we know that it's all about the torque.
It is all about the torque. Right.
The angle of the spoon, the torque.
Torque and dork. That's
torque, dork.
And that's torque. I'm gonna have...
We're dorks. Well, the top row.
So get a little towels out.
The dullest host in TV.
Put the oils on the rim of the cocktail glass.
No.
And then
just like an old fashioned.
Exactly.
Sort of. Yeah.
And then kind of put it on the edge. And
yeah.
Cheers. Here we go. The rest
that
of
is beautiful. Fantastic.
Cheers.
Cheers, kids.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Dink, clink, dink, clink.
It really works. It works well with whiskey.
It does. Yes.
That's delicious.
It makes sense because it's kind of a Christmassy nature of it. I mean, it's kind of like Manhattan without the so much, you know, so often, well, I'm in Philadelphia, so all the vermouth here has oregano and thyme in it. It's all martini and rosé, right? You know, even Dolan can be pretty arid. So this is kind of a really fun twist on a Manhattan of sorts.
It's very.
I'm going to be curious to hear what you say later on the on my Amara, because I have some of those green cooking spices in there as well. So
yeah,
you can taste that out to you.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
So Andre, let's see what you've been up to. I know we are getting kind of post-pandemic-ish. So last time we talked to you, you were talking about getting out there with the book a bit. So you must be getting out there with the book a bit.
Getting out there with the book a bit. So Booze Cruise hit its month mark, I think, yesterday or the day before. Batman's in its third weekend. I can't even remember anymore. Putting out books is just like the beginning. So it's always a marketing haul for the entire year I'm doing stuff. But my first live event is in Pittsburgh, and we're doing an immersive experience at a Korean bar there, a hot new Korean bar called Cobra. So I'm excited. We have 4 or 5 cocktails, 2 from the book. I actually got my friend Keith Motzi, who's the head bartender of the Four Seasons in Seoul at the famous bar called Charles H. Baker, is sending over like a friend of the bar cocktail. So we're doing that. And it's been bonkers doing the 2 books. I mean, basically, I was always hopeful or thought that the 2 books would have very different clientele, the very different readers. And that so far has been pretty true. The Batman people, all I needed to do is make Batman people happy, and they seem thrilled. So, you know, they are loving the book. So that book just goes on its own. And then most of the tour that I'm doing is for Booze Cruise. I have, again, yeah, you're right. Things are in really weird transition. I have a couple of virtual events. I have one in Seattle at Book Larder. I'm getting my conversation partner is Penelope Bass from Imbibe. So that will be really fun to have her talk about Booze Cruise. But then a lot of people are getting Zoom fatigue. So a lot of bookstores just finding that people aren't coming on in the same numbers they were. So I'm switching over to live events. I'm probably doing quite a few events through the summer and fall.
Oh, that's awesome.
You'll see more Booze Cruise. And because of the title, somehow Booze Cruise sort of works for summer anyway.
Tell us what Booze Cruise is all about.
Yeah, Booze Cruise. So Booze Cruise is over 40 cocktail destinations around the world. I visited many of them over the years, but the final push was going around the world. I did a circumnavigation of the globe right before the pandemic. So it's got basically 2 cocktails per each city. There's some food in there. In fact, there's Glögg in there for Stockholm.
Nice.
A good crossover, so I was excited for tonight. There's, you know, a lot of what it's like to drink in these cities, what's on the ground, what's been going on there, how many years the craft cocktail scene has been going there. So it's a fun book. I tried to make it very accessible for Americans. So all the drinks are, say, you know, drinks from Hong Kong, but there are ingredients that you can get in the U.S., and they should be pretty simple for the home bartender. So they're good. It's a good cocktail book to do some armchair travel while we can't go to Asia yet.
You didn't dumb it down for us Americans, did you?
No, not dumb down, but definitely.
Really?
You know, there's not as many ISI whippers and not as many. You know, not everybody has a roto evaporator at home.
Myself too.
Pretty much, once you head east of Dubai, every bar has a roto evaporator right outside on the bar. So they're into some pretty heavy tech over there.
Typing Amazon roto.
I don't even know what that is.
I don't even know what that is myself.
Yeah, you have clarifications. Basically, you're removing solids and colors from liquids. They have all kinds of crazy stuff going on over there. And some of those cities, the bars are allowed to distill their own liquor. So you can go into a bar that's actually also essentially a micro distillery. So
wow.
They've driven down to the elements of what makes a craft cocktail bar.
So you were in Sweden. When were you in Sweden?
Me? Oh, it's been a while since I was in Sweden.
Okay.
I have European roots, so I've been over there. I'm actually Swiss. My mother's Swiss. And I love it because everyone confuses, in the United States, everyone confuses Switzerland and Sweden. Yep. It's like, well, I'm the European country that starts with an SW. Who does that? And we don't have reindeer.
Aussieland.
Yeah, they're right next to each other on the map.
Like,
if you look, they're only like that cousins. Far apart.
Yeah, pretty close. They're pretty close.
A couple of, a couple of countries and you know, a big body of water.
Sure. Yeah.
That's right. So now let's talk about Batman. Talk about the Batman book.
Yeah, the Batman has gone off like a bomb. People, the Batman fans are loving it. Those were all 70 originals. So it's the first time that I've done a book of originals, basically. I've been writing about cocktails for 20 years. I've owned my own bar. But I was always on the journalist side, and I always thought, I'll just collect these from other bartenders. And this was the first time where the contract was 70 originals. That weren't anybody else's. They were part of this Batman universe. So I didn't have a lot of options. I did have friends help recipe test everything. It's a lot of classics. I assumed that people picking up the Batman book, it would be sort of baby's first cocktail book in a way. I think there's a lot of new people that aren't craft cocktailers or even much of cocktailers at all picking that book up. So I wanted to make sure that if they went through the book, they would come out of that. They would come out of their Batman fandom as pretty decent cocktailers too. So that was pretty important to me. So the book has a lot of twists, and the book was just really hilariously fun to write. It was so amazing. When DC Comics approached me about it, I basically said, there's only one way to do it. And that's be really serious about it. Pretend that, there's a whole cocktail backstory for Gotham City. Pretend that all these cocktails are from bartenders from Gotham City based on characters. And they went for it. So the book has a lot of great backstory on every cocktail. So it was just really fun. It's all character and place based from the comics, not from the movies. So we're not in Christopher Nolan land. We're in written comic land.
Oh, that's very cool. That is very cool.
Now, were you a comic book person growing up or no?
Yeah, funny enough, when they called to do this, I was basically like, well, Batman is really the only one I feel confident of being able to do. Mm-hmm. I also really loved X-Men. But Batman really is appealing for cocktailers, I think. For one, Batman is a regular guy. He's a vigilante without superpowers. Makes him really compelling as a character. The backstory is really amazing. Batman came out in 1939. There is some drinking in the beginning of it. Everybody thinks of the Batman universe. There isn't drinking. Of course, if anybody's read the stuff from the 80s, Batman was actually an alcoholic and he was recovering. So there's a lot of stuff going on with alcohol and Batman. But what was interesting is when the Batman comics came out in 1939, that is a pretty great era for cocktails too. The United States was recovering from Prohibition. People were really into cocktails. And these characters just jump out as these kind of late 30s characters. So it was easy to hang really interesting American style cocktails with these characters like the Joker and Penguin and Falcone and some of these guys. So, and Gotham City is supposed to be a city somewhere south of New York City. Well, I live in Philadelphia, so Gotham City is my home. So I went with a lot of, for Falcone, I have a variation of an Americano with balsamic, which I can imagine one of the mobsters that lives near me probably would enjoy.
Wow, that's cool. What a good backstory on a cool book. That's neat.
Yeah, it was really fun.
You don't see that from the MCU, do you? That's a DC cool thing.
Yeah. Yeah, DC was really incredible to work with. You know, they had issues with not wanting their characters to be said to be drinking. So there is a little note about, inspiration at the top. But otherwise, the backstories are totally legit. And they let me do whatever I wanted to. I thought the Joker's bonkers. So obviously, he's into both mezcal and absinthe and whatever else you can
do. A lot of green.
And, Poison Ivy, she obviously loves chartreuse. So some of these just, some of the characters wrote themselves. Mr. Freeze, of course, has a really, I won't say terrible, a wonderfully campy variation on like a blue Hawaii, right? So it's like a frozen pineapple drink. It's just, we were just having fun with it.
How does that come about? Do you come up with that idea and go to DC, or does DC come to you, or was there some intermediary that said, hey, this will be a fun idea?
This was one of the weirdest ones of my whole career, and that I had met a guy who was drawing in the DC universe, not connected to the company. And we started doing a cocktail book that was a comic book. You've seen that a few times. You know, some people have done it famously as their bar menus. But the idea was to follow two characters that had superpowers. And the cocktail book would actually be the notebook they were keeping while they were trying to open their new bar. And of course, there was an evil journalist and an evil tycoon that wanted to put their bar out of business, and they had to overcome all these things. And somebody from DC saw it and reached out to me to do the book.
Wow.
So totally wild. I had put it on I'd put some pages on the web. I'd been asking around if anybody wanted to publish that. And they were like, we would like you to do Batman. And I thought about it for precisely 1 second before saying that. I actually called my agent and said, I think I just agreed to write Batman. She was like, you should have called first.
Because we could have socked it to him more.
Yeah, it was, you know, what franchises aren't too cheesy to do. You know, I had actually been in talks to do Game of Thrones. And then that sort of passed. And at the time, that would have been wonderful as well. But it turns out that Batman might be the ultimate comic for cocktails, just because of the era that it's set in and the gritty detail that the characters have. And Gotham City, basically, I made a whole backstory that Prohibition never came to the Narrows, right? People from all over the East Coast were coming to Gotham City to still have cocktails at these speakeasies, which was probably true, right?
Yeah, sure. Probably.
Wow. Much like Philadelphia.
Yeah, exactly.
And New York.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, Prohibition pretty much failed in New York, didn't it?
Yeah, right. Both for the most part. And Philadelphia, for sure. You always hear about somebody buying a house, knocking down a wall, and finding a speakeasy in it. Uh-huh. My neighborhood has had two or three active speakeasies still up until, you know, the pandemic. So,
from that era?
Well, I don't know if they were unbroken, but it's still part of the vibe down here for sure that there were, you know, known houses that you could go to after 1 a.m. and get a drink with about five or six people in a basement.
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Hey, Mike, your wife might be related to some of these guys.
Yeah. I know,
surprise me. Wouldn't surprise me.
I love that whole era. That whole era is so cool. And when you wrap it up with the DC comic world, Batman, that's just neat. And then throwing cocktails in there. That's a cool combination.
Yeah, it really is. I think it took a lot of people by surprise. It took me by surprise that DC wanted to do it. And I think it took fans by surprise because they, you know, you think of Bruce Wayne as not drinking. But we did some really fun stuff where there's a suit up espresso drink that both the cops drink and he drinks. We have a couple low proof drinks for Catwoman. You know, how does she, you know, stay on her feet? After drinking at cocktail parties and then getting on rooftops.
What does Alfred drink?
Oh, Alfred I had fun with because I wasn't allowed to go into too much depth on his backstory. But he, of course, in theory, worked for the Secret Service for his father and was stationed in Burma. So there's a lot of, lime leaf, gin and tonics. I did a Pimm's cup for his father, which I made up a backstory for. I mean, I went pretty deep. I have Martha and the father's wedding cocktail in the book as well. And you know, like canapes and stuff that were found at Gotham City fundraisers. So it's, you know, we went there. Wherever we could go, we went there.
Sure.
Yeah.
So we are, we're looking, I'm really excited about that book.
There's no glue in it though. So next time,
yeah, that's right.
Swedish character. But
you know, the Swedish Batman is very cool.
The Swedish Batman, yeah.
Hey, you can get Joel Kinnaman to play him.
Oh, that'd be perfect.
Right?
He'd be great. He'd be great.
Hey, by the way, this drink is really, really good.
It is. You know, I don't know what the hell I'm doing with a cocktail, and I actually made a pretty good cocktail.
This makes a really nice and easy cocktail, and it still has a little bit of complexity to it, which is always fun.
Give me some other ideas for the glug. Where else would you put it? Could you put it in like a mulled wine or... So
let me stop you right there before you go any further, because traditionally, glug is made made with wine. So it's technically is a mulled wine. It's just that my great grandmother, having to steal in the backyard, used the spices in a spirit instead of a wine.
I want your grandmother.
Yeah, the years don't play.
The mulled wine, so you can actually add red wine into it.
Interesting.
So yeah, no, you can definitely add a little wine to it and make it more of a traditional style wine glug.
I can see it in a hot toddy.
The glue wine.
So I've seen it more like a hot toddy.
Yeah, totally.
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, the easiest thing, as I said in the beginning here, is just is substitute for sweet vermouth in classic cocktails, and then you can try around with a whole bunch of different things. But I also make, like, it blends with bourbon. It goes with rum. It goes with gins. I mean, it's kind of crazy how versatile it is. So, like, I do a sour, Stockholm sour is called. It's like 50-50 spit base, basically, gin and glug, lemon juice, a little simple syrup, and an egg white. And it's just fantastic.
Yeah. So we're going to move on to Martin's orange liqueur. Is that where we're going next?
Yep.
That's right.
So tell us about that one, Martin.
Oh, by the way, I didn't mention this earlier, but the labels are actually inspired by California license plates. And a lot of people in California will recognize this color combination. It's the 80s. Yeah. But I also designed the labels, right? So I'm like, I thought I was super smart. And like, because when it lays down flat, you can see the rectangular shape of a license plate. But when you put it on a round bottle, you kind of lose that aspect. So it's not as easy to see. I learn, you know, each time I do a little bit of design and implementation. And then, oh, crap. I didn't think of that. So this orange liqueur, I'm going to just taste it on its own as well, real quick. It's the, in terms of ingredients, the simplest product that I make. It only has three ingredients. It's orange peel, bitter orange peel, and vanilla bean. Even the vanilla bean is distilled. So you get this sort of sense of sweetness from the vanilla. So we don't have to add as much sugar as you do in other orange liqueurs. So this has, this is a triple sec style. And it has about half of the sugar that you would normally find in triple sec. And you actually get a little bit of viscosity and mouthfeel from the vanilla bean as well.
So this is 40% ABV, right? Wow.
That ain't no joke.
That is a sipper.
No, it's great.
And so, it makes it a little drier and easier to drink. It's not as cloyy and it's not as syrupy when you drink it.
No, not at all. So you add no sugar to this?
Oh, no, there's sugar in it, but it's about half the sugar of other orange liqueurs. So this still means about 14 to 15% sugar content, which, believe it or not, is low for a liqueur.
Yeah, it's crazy, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I seriously hate sugar, which is really weird because I make liqueurs, right? You know, and yet, like, I'm in that space where everything needs sugar. So I try everything I can in all of my products to find ingredients. It lends itself to have a sense of sweetness, so I don't have to add sugar into it.
No, so fantastic. This would be perfect for, as a substitute for any kind of simple syrup, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is not as sweet as a sweet substitute, but you could definitely like half the base of the simple syrup because simple syrup is 50% sugar, right? If it's just a regular and it's not a rich simple.
You really get the vanilla.
Nice. That's very nice. It's got a nice mouth.
Yeah, that kind of makes the whole product, actually, the vanilla.
It's like a creamsicle.
Yeah, I was going to say it's like a creamsicle.
You're right.
It's right, right?
You're absolutely right.
Vanilla and orange, right?
And I think a little bit of a kick. Today was adult cream National Cognac Day. Oh, sorry.
You know, that wouldn't be a bad idea, would it? An adult cream or like a vanilla orange sherbet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A little boozy vanilla orange sherbet.
Yeah, you could probably just pour this over ice cream, basically.
That'd be nice. All right.
You could, just for sure.
Actually, a European dessert that I came across, actually when I lived in Switzerland for a short time, was lemon sorbet and absolute citrone.
Delicious. Wow. Those Swiss, man, they're always like they're on the ski slope and then they're having sorbet.
I know. And they're chocolates.
I know. They're fancy watches.
Fancy watches. Uh-huh. Yeah, Swiss. Oh. They're always on time.
We don't have the Swiss don't have the same sauna. They don't have the same sauna scene as Sweden
does. No, they yeah, exactly.
Or the good furniture. Although it's not bad, but they're not famous for it.
This is the sidecar, right?
This is going to be the sidecar. Now, there is always a debate on the sidecar whether or not to use a sugared rim. Right? So some people are in the sugar camp on the rim, some are not, because it's a very dry cocktail. It doesn't have any simple syrup, so it'll be very dry and very boozy. Right? So what you can do to kind of get away from that is kind of half sugar the rim, right?
That's what I was
going to say. So hold on. I'm bringing my glass out of the freezer here. That's why I'm out of frame, I'm assuming. I am out of frame. Yes.
But you're still with us.
Okay, yeah. I'm actually going to sugar half the rim of my glass first. So just to make sure that I have a little bit, because this will be a very, 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 very dry cocktail. So it actually will be nice to have a little sugar to kind of cut that dryness. And I heard today is also a National Cognac Day. So this is a really good day to do at the sidebar.
I thought it was National Donut Day.
Maybe it's full.
Sidecars.
There's so many days of anything.
Sidecar donut.
There's our new new drive up truck, right? Donuts and sidecars.
Oh, that's and, good, why not?
There's a donut place out here called Sidecar Donut.
Oh, nice.
Wow. Yes.
They need to add this. They need to add this cocktail.
So this will be an ounce and a half of cognac, and it's going to be 0.75, 3/4 of an ounce of the orange liqueur. And then the same amount, 3/4 of an ounce of lemon juice, if anybody's following along. I at least pre-squeezed the lemon, so I don't have to squeeze it. Mm-hmm. And when I shake a cocktail, I actually like to use different size ice cubes. So I use the small, like 1 1/4 ice cube, and then the big 2-inch ice cubes. And that actually gives you a different frothing and aerates the cocktail in a different way, so you get a different... not only froth, but also mouthfeel out of the cocktail.
Well, that's nice. That's not super sugary. I didn't do the sugar, though. I didn't do the sugar.
I didn't do the sugar though, either, but it almost doesn't need it.
I thought a sidecar was with orange. Is it with
it
orange?
It can be with lemon. It can be with orange. I also have a blood orange one, which is what I wanted to make, but I couldn't find any at the store.
Martin, are all the botanicals and fruits that you get for all of these items... All of these SKUs, are they from California?
Not all of them, because there's some exotic spices. I try to source everything I can from a local store called San Francisco Herb Company, SF Herb Company. So that's my go-to place, and I get about 80% of my botanicals from there. And then we have a lemon twist that we put on. Right.
That's a nice lemon twist.
Yeah.
Fancy.
There we go.
You know, the Swedes are very good at the lemon twist. A lot of people don't know that.
It's all those lemon trees.
Cheers. We're known for our citrus fruit in Sweden.
That's delicious.
So this is definitely a cocktail for people who are not like the sort of tropical super sweet cocktails. It's dry, it's very straightforward.
Oh, wow.
This is a little tart.
And you definitely
too.
Get the whole cognac component in there.
Now, what kind of cognac did everyone use?
I used the regular Remy.
I used a Montreux, and I cannot remember the name of the one that I had from a tasting I had recently.
Okay.
I use Berto.
Yeah, I had a Hennessy that I think was their Master Blender series or something.
Oh, delicious.
That was pretty good. It was good. Yeah, it was very good. It's more bourbon-y than cognac-y.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Perfect.
This is nice.
This almost has like a whiskey. Well, because of the cognac I use, it has more of like a whiskey sour kind of vibe.
Yeah, whiskey sour.
Yeah, kind of definitely vibe. Whiskey sourish.
Which I'm fine with that. I like it.
Yeah.
You could throw an egg white in there. Ah.
Oh, right. Oh,
sidecar sour.
I'll be right back.
That would be awesome. Sour
invented here tonight.
Because everything's better with an egg white.
Kind of true.
Wow. Much.
I'm also camp egg white. I love egg white.
Yeah. I don't disagree with that. I love that as so well. Good.
Because also, when it separates, it's so cool.
Yeah. But I also love a sidecar. It's really funny. When I was first getting into cocktails, one of the first drinks I gravitated to, probably just because of the name or the old men at the bar drank it, was the Rusty Nail. And then I feel like a long time ago when the craft cocktail movement was starting, the sidecar was definitely always on the menu, you know? And it's gotten a bad rap recently. I keep seeing articles like, oh, this sidecar is never good. And it's like, well, I don't know. It's been around for over 100 years. So
it's
pretty good.
Isn't that weird how things kind of come and go like that? And all of a sudden some writer gets all uppity because they had a bad drink somewhere. And all of a sudden, old fashioned suck.
Oh,
what
I
are you
know.
Talking about? Dude. So
the fadness of it is hilarious. It's like it's a sidecar. It'll be okay. Go sit down.
The sidecar was forbidden in my house. My father would go out with my uncle. And my uncle would make such a to-do about how no one made the sidecar correctly that he would then send them back and then eventually have to go and make the sidecar himself to show them how it's done. Then my father was like, never get a sidecar, ever. Never get a sidecar.
Was it the proportions or was it the ingredients?
Like, I think it was my uncle more than anything. I think he's just one of those flamboyant guys who has to show you how it's done.
Okay.
you know, I think when the sidecar sort of shed its sugar rim is really when it actually took off. And I also love, I do it with margaritas too. I get half salt, you know, because you don't need to have something in the way of every sip that you have, you know. But if you want to have a little sugar and add to it, it's perfect. I feel like, you know, obviously younger palates at the bar, if they're discovering the sidecar, they love that sugar rim. And I think it's safe to say when you get to our age, you don't like it anymore.
But isn't part of the salt rim and the sugar rim, it's about a lot of it's about presentation, right?
Yeah.
It's not about it's
part of the garnish.
Exactly. It looks cool.
And, well, you know, it's funny.
You drink with your eyes too, right? You know, you have a nice looking ice cube in there. You got a good garnish. You know, the cocktail is going to taste better.
And, you know, when the sidecar came around, when it's kind of, I believe, comes from this really old drink called the Brandy Crusta, which is the first drink to have a sugar rim. It was just not only an elegant presentation, but sugar was for the wealthy. So you could go and when there was sugar around the outside, that was a fancy, expensive drink because you just didn't put sugar on stuff like that. So it was just a fun, elegant, and we forget that this was really a luxury item to have sugar on there.
Interesting, Andre, you brought that up. So when you were traveling, when you traveled around and you wrote Brews Cruise, did you see those kinds of different philosophical, cultural views of cocktails where sugar in one country might be kind of highbrow, but in other countries it may not be?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, some countries have more sugar tolerance, I would say, than others. And that's just part of their food culture and part of what they like. And what's been interesting is even in my own lifetime in the United States, when I first started drinking at cocktail bars, no one drank anything bitter ever. So the fact that we've gone from, you know, just sweet drinks, basically bad sweet drinks from the 80s to Negronis has been a phenomenal growth in the American palate, which is really pretty amazing. One of the cultural things that's really big that I think that I saw the most is something like Japan, where cocktails really take their place in the broader food culture there. For instance, you know, the Japanese basically, you know, in some of the cuisine, they have like 13 seasons kind of thing, and the food all has to speak to place and season. And I was finding that cocktails have that as well. They speak to time of day and place and season and what's in season. And I feel like for sure on the West Coast, you know, spots like San Francisco and spots like Vancouver, you start seeing that, where I think that's some of where we're headed in the American cocktail stuff is to really put cocktails in context. I see that in San Francisco a lot. And I don't think San Francisco gets enough national media attention for doing that. People forget San Francisco is using fresh juice before New York ever did. But we all have to tell the lie that New York created the craft cocktail. This is something that Camper English talks about a lot. New York exceptionalism, where New York created everything, including the cocktail. And it's like, so every time I go to San Francisco, which has been a while now, but I'm always really excited by all the fresh seasonal flavors that they're using, which, you know, Martin has direct access to how much to that seasonality and stuff. So,
yeah. And God, do I love that. I mean, it's so much fun to play around, as you say, when ingredients become available. I mean, we get everything from like lychee to dragon fruit, right? That we can play around with. So, I mean, it's always something fun to play around.
Yeah.
I mean, when I discovered yuzu, I mean, it was just such an incredible citrus to play with. Yeah. And now it's everywhere.
Martin, what's the cocktail scene like in your home country? Are people, is it growing?
It's catching up.
Is it?
Yeah. I mean, they're way behind. Like 10 years ago, there was not a single craft cocktail bar in Stockholm, right? And then just about 10 years ago, they started popping up a little bit here and there. And now there's a good spread of cocktail bars. And they make some really fun stuff where presentation is killer. So I went to one place a couple of years ago now. It's called 2005, which is spelled 2005. 2005, but you know, but it's spelled out as
what
a word,
say?
The numbers, and like they, things are getting a little spotty here. Let's see, I'm gonna make sure I'm on. It didn't switch on me. No,
can you hear us?
I don't know. I can hear you.
I can hear you. Martin's got some Wi-Fi issues, I think. When Andre, when you were traveling around, aside from sugar, is there? Do you see the philosophies different from culture to culture? how cocktails are part of the culture.
It's become a thing, I think, just even in the last 5 years, as Martin was saying, you know, 10 years ago, there wasn't much in these other cities. They were typically wine or beer towns or, you know, drinking liqueur after dinner. I know growing up in a Swiss household, you never had cocktails, but you would drink a little liqueur after dinner. And, you know, certainly like some kind of schnapps or something, which is part of Germanic culture. But it just in the last 5 years, yeah, cocktails have really exploded, and it's been fascinating to watch. I was really fascinated that cocktails sort of brought their own establishment with them too. It's not just that you have a cocktail, but you have cocktail bars, which are like new types of experiences that people, a new type of thing that people can go into. You know, even I feel like even in the United States, we've had bars forever, we have bars since Prohibition, but in the 80s. That had deteriorated, so it was sort of steakhouses and sports bars and taverns and nightclubs. And the cocktail bar really brought back something new. And it's been fascinating to watch that happen around the world.
What is that?
What is that, Martin?
That's the Appenzeller, a Swiss after dinner.
Yes!
Liqueur.
Yes!
It's really cool stuff.
What is that? What's it made out of?
It's Appenzeller. Like, what do you mean you don't know?
It's made out of cheese.
And cheese curds in it.
It's kind of like an herbaceous bittersweet liqueur. It's super tasty, very honest forward, but it's super
little
tasty.
Little known fact. It is the only liqueur with an expiration date that is actually accurate to the minute.
What? Yes. Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Certified by Omega and Rolex. Yeah,
it comes with Swiss timing.
It's funny you said that. I was talking to a friend of ours, Bazi Karasu, who is one of the most well-known whiskey bloggers in the world. He lives here in Los Angeles. He's from Turkey. And he was telling us how, which I didn't even think about this, that every culture seems to have, maybe not in the United States, but every other country has an anise-based liqueur. Yeah. It is weird. I never even thought of that because we don't really have one in this country, do we? I don't think so. But everywhere else,
yeah, not really.
Anise is a thing to make, you know, an anise forward spirit.
From Pernod.
And I get apparently in Sweden too.
Yeah.
Sambuca on his head, Ouzo.
Isn't that strange?
Yeah. Even Guaro, you know, in Colombia, it has an anise flavor to it. It's crazy. Yeah. I mean, Americans know pastis, maybe, and ouzo, but they don't like it. So what's
right? But they're coming from other countries.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think though. In New Orleans, right? Because that's where the Sazerac comes from.
Mm-hmm, the Pichard.
What did they use?
Pichard bitters.
Yeah, okay. They use the Pichard bitters, but I think you're thinking of
when absinthe
they switched to Pernod. Yeah, that's an interesting observation that everybody has sort of an ouzo.
Everyone does, and. Like
on a set, sorry.
Yeah, and the Rocky, as we talked about with our friend at Yerbiga, which there's a Rocky, there's a plum spirit in a lot of countries too.
Yeah.
Right. Yep.
That monkey is drinking an Anisette, by the way, in the painting there. It's
a good monkey. Yeah.
Of course he is.
Well, Ange, what are the Italian ones? There's a lot, right?
You've got between Anisette and Sambuca alone, and then God knows there's probably a bunch of variations in between.
And then they migrate themselves into the Amaro world, right?
Well, and then black licorice is, you know, that's also a thing too, between the licorice candies and all that good stuff. And I love all that stuff. So
it's probably, you know, Americans, they were just, people were just fighting for survival for so long that, you know, when you look back, it's like they were just drinking what they could make here, which turned into being rum and whiskey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, they just didn't have a liqueur culture other than up north, I think, when the Germans and the Eastern Europeans started to settle in places like Minnesota and Wisconsin and Michigan, where you could get plums. I think there's a pretty good tradition of liqueurs up there. And certainly now in the Pacific Northwest, probably makes the U.S.'s best liqueurs. But just it's just fact of being too new. Although, yeah.
The tax structure kills a lot of stuff in the U.S.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's true.
You look at Italy, they make all the wine, and then they distill the skins and make all the grappa. You make a lot of wine in the U.S. No one makes grappa because well, that's another license. It's another tax. It's another business. It's another something else. Where I think a lot of that kind of kills that stuff up front because it's just, like you said, you started a company in 2012. You weren't up and running for 2 years because of all the stuff you had to do. Well, if you put on a second SKU, it's another 2 years. And a third SKU is another 2 years. And, you know, it's just, it's almost counterproductive with a lot of the regulations that come in where a lot of the European countries, anyway, it was second nature to make all this stuff. And they didn't tax it until after it was already up and running.
It's amazingly complicated here.
Yeah.
The good news is, though, it's not 2 years for every other SKU after that. The first one is to get the permit of making distilled liquor. You have to fill in, and I kid you not, it's like a stack this thick of papers, fingerprinted 25 different times. I list every person I talked to for the last 10 years, et cetera, right? You know, it's a long process. After that, all you have to do is file COLAs. Which is the recipe approval. And that's used to be about 6 to 8 weeks, but they've actually kicked it up a notch. So you can now get recipe approval in a week.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's actually not that bad anymore.
Yeah.
Right. Well, there's so many people doing it now, too.
Sure.
They have to speed it up, you know, and they're just giving away tax revenue because if they can't get the thing on the shelf.
When I started this thing, right, there was maybe 400 to 500 active DSPs, distiller licenses, in the US. So every time I talk to a distributor, hey, I got a glug. They're like, ooh, that's interesting. Let's try it. Let's bring it on. Now, fast forward when I released my other products 5 years later, there were about 3,000 DSPs. And everybody is releasing the same type of spirits. And everybody wants to be in New York, Illinois, Florida, Texas, and California. So, I mean, these distributors, they get 500 emails a day. Hey, I got a found the cure. You want to try it?
Yeah.
It's not as easy anymore, right?
Yeah.
It's a different world out there.
Staggering growth.
We just had here in California, the governor said that cocktails to go are going to be an ongoing thing here in California, which is
I hope it's
amazing
permanent.
Compared to where we were pre-pandemic, where we were in prohibition law world still in a lot of ways, right? Yeah. We were talking,
but the world didn't end, right? People took away their cocktails and they didn't start fights in the park.
No, you know,
they
exactly.
Enjoying themselves.
Yes, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
I think we were talking to Joshua Hatton a while back. I was, you know, in Europe, it's no problem to send samples anywhere, right? Advent calendars are a big deal where you got like 24 different whiskeys or 24 different spirits that are going in a gift pack. You can't do that here. Because every bottle has to have a tax stamp. And so it's a complicated, everyone has to, it's just way too complicated. So no one does that kind of stuff. It's amazing that you even see little sample bottles from what, Compass Box or Glenfiddich or whatever at BevMo. It's way too hard to get stuff to your palate.
Well, I mean, 50 mil is an approved size. By the TTB. Right. So you know, you don't have to run through the extra hoops there, right? You just have to pay volume taxes once you take it out of your bonded warehouse. And they just recently, 2 months ago, approved 700 mils and the 500 mils as well. So now we have
the
European side. So it's going to be a huge help of getting European brands into the US because they don't have to start new bottling lines. New volumes, new labels, you know, it's all going to have to be the same. And they can put a little sticker on the back, you know, with the whatever government warning extras that we have to have on our labels, right? That's going to just be a sticker on the back and it's done.
I mean, let's face it, there's money to be made here. And if you leave people out, that's just less product for consumers.
That's right.
And if it doesn't sell, well, then it'll just stop coming here. But if it does sell, well, that's one less thing they have to do.
And it makes it so much easier on the manufacturer in whatever country to get their product to the biggest market, one of the biggest markets in the world.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
You want to be here, but I've got to get 750 bottles. We don't have those in wherever whatever country. It's crazy.
Right.
Yep.
And I mean, I'm just looking at myself as a very small producer, right? Like my warehouse space is extremely limited. If I have to double up on my inventory just to have 700s and 750s it just doesn't work.
Yeah. It's nuts. It's crazy. So we're going to go to the Amaro now?
Yes. Let's do it.
This is, This is Andre's world, I bet. I bet you Andre's an Amaro guy.
I do have a lot of Amaros. That's
funny. How did I know that? I just have a feeling.
It happened by accident, and it happened, I think, well, I don't know why it happened. Amaros is one of those things you get two or three, and all of a sudden you have 12. They breed in the night.
They're like,
exactly right. Should go to Amaro. Exactly before right. you,
Gremlins,
before you have
don't drink them after 12.
Oh, my God.
That is what's the word? Herbaceous?
Herbaceous.
Yep, herbaceous.
Yeah, this is actually the one I didn't try in advance, so this is exciting.
Oh, good. Yeah, I get this natural reaction. I always love that.
Yeah, this is fantastic. So much.
That's got a lot of. It's an herb garden in a glass.
It has 31 different herbs, roots, and barks in there.
What makes an Amaro an Amaro?
And a Fernet a Fernet.
And a Fernet a Fernet.
Yeah. There is really no rules governing that. Like historically, it used to be that Fernets were more medicine type, designed to cure illnesses. So they had a lot less sugar, higher alcohol, and were a lot more bitter. And Amaros were actually intended to be kind of consumed after a meal. So it was intended to be potable. But since the early 1900s, that hasn't really been the case. Yeah. And the further we move into this space, you know, you got cross-pollinations. You have completely unsweetened Amaros and you have super sweet Fernets. So there's really nothing that ties one into another camp or another. Like Amaro is a more well-known word. Mm-hmm. So it's easier to release an Amaro than a Fernet because Fernet actually has some sort of negative connotation to it that is more aggressive and a little harder to for the untrained palate to drink.
Huh.
And a lot of that comes from, you know, people think Fernet is Fernet Branca, and that's it, right? They think the category is the name brand. And, you know, Fernet Branca is a great product, but it's not good for everything. It's not super approachable, and somebody who's never tried an herbaceous liqueur before, they're going to have a reaction to it, right?
Right.
So I usually say that my Fernet is like getting slapped in the face, but in a good way.
So, of course, because why wouldn't that be a nice thing?
Right. Yeah. So I could have technically called my Fernet an Amaro if I wanted to, and I could have gotten away with it. And people would say, oh, that's fine. Okay, that's an Amaro. I could have called this Amaro a Fernet, and I could have gotten away with it. And people would say, yeah, that's a Fernet. But purposely, I put this just to kind of stay true to the definition that we kind of live with, is my Fernet is slightly higher proof. And this is slightly lower proof. This is 38% versus 40%. They do have the same sugar level, so it's not really sweeter. But this has lighter spices, lighter herbs in it than the Fernet does.
Okay. I don't know, Martin. I think this still slapped me in the face. So who knows?
Yeah, but you had a comment. Let's face it.
I didn't deserve it.
can you tell us what's in here?
Yeah, so some of the really unique botanicals in this one versus other Amaros is going to be my Scandinavian influence. So the big thing that you're going to capture on the nose immediately, the little musky smell there, that's birch bark. And then you have sea buckthorn and heather flowers all stemming from up the north. That kind of gives it that Scandinavian flair to it.
Mike was going to guess buckthorn.
A Dutch birch beer kind of back note to it.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, that's fun.
Wow, that is fun.
You know, this would make a nice highball.
Yes, absolutely. Sure. Yes.
You know, just like this and some club soda.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe a little orange peel.
Yeah. Just keep it absolutely simple. Spot on. And it would be a low ABV, all you drink all day kind of cocktail.
Right. We like to drink all day.
Yeah.
Breakfast. You know, as our dear friend Sam would say, you can't drink all day if you don't start in the morning.
That's a good point. So this one has those little green cooking spices in there. So it has oregano, tarragon, and thyme. So, Andre, I want to see if that kind of jumps out at you because I know you mentioned that on the vermouth side.
They don't jump out at me. They're really well integrated. And now I definitely got the birch, which I sort of thought was pine in the beginning. But now I'm definitely catching the background.
It has that Mike.
Beautiful like pine resin kind of thing going on that I love, that I find pretty unique. And I think that you get some of the berry, some of that big that buckthorn comes through.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
It's really nicely integrated. I also really like the mouthfeel on this. It seems like you pay attention to that for sure.
Yeah, totally. It's a huge component for me when I produce something. And this is a very complicated production method because because of the botanical, some actually has to be hydrosol macerated. Some is macerated high proof, some in low proof, some hot, and some cold. And then everything is blended together. So it's a lot of technique going into making this product.
So why do you have to do it different ways? It's just because of the way the oils release in each of the different botanicals?
Exactly. Yeah. So some don't actually release an alcohol at all. They actually need water as a solvent, especially flowers and lighter greens. They want water to dissolve in. Whereas oils, they tend to be picked up better by high alcohol content, for example. So you have like 150, 160 proof that you macerated in.
So are you pretty much, I mean, have you learned this all on your own, just starting with the GLOG and just evolving, or like how'd you
train for this? School.
Yeah.
Yes.
That you went to Swedish spirits camp.
So in terms of permits, I am not permitted to be a distiller. So I actually have, you see on the bottle, it says produced by Coastal Spirits. So he is also a one-man operation, one-man distiller. So he's distilling it on contract for me because if you have a distilling license, you don't necessarily have a distribution license, right? So you can't have everything and you can't touch to end customer from production.
Right.
Because again, we're archaic that way. So I actually have to have somebody produce it for me or I could not be able to distribute it myself. Now I don't need to distribute it myself anymore because now I have a distributor. Mm. So that's kind of the background to why it says Coastal Spirits on the side of the bottle. So his name is Brad Plummer, and he's a fantastic guy that has really taken my spirits to heart. He's a gin maker at heart, so he really knows how to work with botanicals. And then I have challenged him with my spirits. I mean, he hadn't made or even had an aquavit before he started making mine. And so we've kind of learned in this process together, and we work very closely together to get these out.
Very cool.
And the spirits, they're not like sticky.
No,
you know, they're not coming through as like almost syrupy sweet or too viscous.
No,
it's almost like the right balance. It's really a kind of a clean spirit, but all the flavors there. It's really well done.
Yeah, so that's nice. Work so hard on that component, specifically the sugar component, because I push it down until you start noticing the ill effect of not having enough sugar. Right. So, but it needs to be right on the cusp because I don't want to mask anything with sugar. It's all about having the right proportions from the beginning, right? Because then you don't really need to mask it. So my Fernet, for example, which is an easy comparison, we don't have it with us today here, but that has half the sugar of other Fernets. But I was lucky enough to be able to start, as I said earlier, like Fernets came about really as medicine. So it was never intended to be potable. So when they transferred those recipes to actual human consumption, they just added enough sugar to cover the bitterness, right? And that ended up being a lot of sugar. I started from a clean slate, so I didn't have that baggage with me when I started designing these.
So what's our next? What was our this last cocktail? Is the
I don't even know.
It's called the tranquilizer.
The tranquilizer.
We're way past that.
Then we're going to take a nap, and then we're going to take a nap live, and then we're going to come back like 30 minutes later. I'm just going to watch this. We're going to find out who snores and who doesn't snore.
Interesting coming back to this. Just letting it get some air.
That's really nice.
The Amaro really is interesting once it's aerated a little
bit. And it's nice on a rock of ice, too. It sort of opens up with a little bit of water.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what you're going to see pretty quickly, by the way, my spirits, is that they're going to start lushing fairly quickly once you start adding water to them. Because we have so much botanicals in there, we kind of push it to the brim and fill it up. So that's why we have all those full flavors, because we jam pack them with flavors. We don't hold back on the botanicals. It's packed. Like if we would put another bay leaf in there, it would lose, right? So I mean, it's just that's how close we are to the brink of like filling it. So after it sits a while in the bottle, you're gonna start a little bit of sediment falling out. And that's because it's so packed, it falls out of suspension, you know, the solids.
Ooh.
It's going to be, you know, right. It hasn't happened yet in this bottle, but it's going to probably be a little bit floating around after a while.
Nice.
So, but that's perfectly normal. It indicates it's natural products and it's a lot of botanicals.
You can tell people they're getting their money worth. All the botanicals the gin can hold.
It's like, yeah, exactly.
The grain spirit can hold.
It's all,
and if anybody's following along at home, there's going to be 1 ounce of the Amaro.
And yeah, I don't know if there's
any Amaro left in the morning for me.
That's a good thing.
I got one of these little samples. I think this is it for tonight. This is after I sign off, a little Netflix and Seaberry Amaro.
Hey, Andre, what was the brand of that apricot brandy you gave us? Or the apricot liqueur?
You guys are using Rothman and Winter, which is a Austrian company.
That's very good.
Yeah, they do a really nice fresh apricot. Yeah, Angelo came over yesterday to drop off the booth, and I asked, "Do you have any apricot liqueur?" So
yeah,
that is really delicious.
It was kind of funny. I was in Austria about 2 years ago, and in the gas stations that you pull over, that's the only thing they sell is that apricot liqueur. Like no hundreds way. Of bottles really? On display. Yeah, it's crazy. No.
That's fantastic. Funny. That sounded kind of maybe my convenience store.
The gas and sip with the apricot liqueur.
Some cream and Cheetos and really good Austrian liqueur.
Look out, Wawa.
Yeah, it's not a Wawa. No,
that's not a Wawa.
Take your hoagies and bring out the apricot liqueur.
This time I used the Luxardo apricot, though, an ounce and a half of that.
Okay, nice.
And then I think you guys are familiar with the Levantine gin as well, mm-hmm. which we're going to be using.
From our buddies in Tel Aviv.
I'm trying to like to get the clear not to be on the bottle, but there we go.
Milk and honey.
Exactly. And it's going to be 3/4 of an ounce of that.
Ooh, that's really, really nice.
Another Impex product.
I use this one.
Is that too. Again?
Yeah, I used Wild Gin by, I think it's District Distilling in D.C. And it's kind of cool because they take they pick the wild gin, the wild juniper berries out of like West Texas. Yeah. There's a park there. I can't remember the name of the park. I didn't have chocolate bitters. I had something in my cabinet. I don't know what it was. It was called Scrappy's Bitters.
You know, Angostura's just released chocolate bitters. I haven't tried it yet.
Wow. Okay. Good. They always do good stuff. Yeah,
they do. Yeah.
And I didn't have any apricot liqueur, so I used that Boardroom Spirits beet liqueur. Yeah.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh. What's that? That's out of left field, right?
There's a little beet. You know, with everything else.
This is very apricot, but that's not bad because it's really good apricot liqueur.
Yeah.
I use this really amazing artisanal gin that's really rare called Beef Eater.
Whoa, where's it going? Where'd you buy that?
It's so
you never heard of it.
Wow. I bet they have a really nice bottle.
I find when I'm making stuff with new things, Beef Eater is a really good benchmark because it's mm-hmm. kind of
neutral.
Something that's very available to a wide group of people. It's something that a lot of bars use. So I'm like, I'll try it with Beef Eater and see how it behaves.
Yeah.
I use Sipsmith.
And this one has lime peel.
There you go. Yeah, Sipsmith is fantastic.
This is a really interesting cocktail.
This is really good.
And I really like, actually, I like the beet in here.
Yeah, I like the apricot in this.
And what I like to do with this one is just take a little bit of pinch of salt and just add it on top. Okay.
Huh.
Wow.
So.
Look at you. That wasn't in the recipe.
Hey.
I know.
Going off the
show off.
Chart there.
Cheers.
Cheers, guys. I just love the smell of this stuff.
That's good stuff. Yeah.
You know what it's not? When I think of Amaros, I always think of anise, right?
Right.
And this is not that.
No, not at all.
It has a little bit of anise components in there, but like a fennel, but it's not overpowering. Yeah.
It's way in the back.
I think the birch really comes through to me.
Yes.
That it rounds out the cocktail.
Yeah, and the fruit. I mean, it just plays nicely.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's got a nice balance. It's really good.
Yeah, congrats on that one. It's really great tomorrow.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Actually, so I don't care that much for competitions. You know, now and then you always have to drop your spirit in just to see how it compares, right? This Amaro, actually, we won double gold at the San Francisco World Spirits Competition this year. So that was pretty amazing.
Congratulations.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
When you're concocting and playing with ideas, are you thinking of cocktails and where this spirit's going to go to? Or you're thinking it on its own?
Yeah, I'm like, dude, I like herbaceous stuff. I'm going to make something that I want to drink. Like, I want something that I can sit and sip and taste everything that goes into it. So that's a mindset that I go in with. And that's how I build it. And I build it until I like it on my palate. And then, for whatever reason, if it's usable or not in cocktails, that's going to come later. That's not that's not part of the conversation. It's not part of the thought process.
Sure. Andre, I would think that's probably true of most cultures around the globe, that a local spirit initially is designed to drink on its own. The yeah. cocktail thing is secondary.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think it's just been in the last, well, it's probably been almost 10 years where people were really thinking of putting stuff in, you know, designing stuff for cocktails, you know, like House of Ferrand certainly has been, you know, at a forefront of that, making, you know, making up stuff with David Wondrich from the past and mm-hmm. some of that fun stuff, which actually they really have created a number of great products. You know, it's one of those things where the greats make it look easy. And then other people try to do it. There's a lot of brands that come out and like, hey, this is great in cocktails. But if it's, I feel like if it's not fundamentally sound on its own, it really is going to show over time and nobody's going to care about it eventually. Yeah. So, I mean, this is really the, you know, Martin's doing it the absolutely the right way, where you just have to make a product that's fantastic. And, you know, you just don't know, you know, what creativity people are going to come up with it later. You know?
Right.
That's on them. You know, obviously if it's user, I mean, I always feel like a great product eventually finds its home in the cocktail world in some way, you know, and, but, you know, I get a lot of liquors that are trying to be like, this is special for the cocktail market, you know, and it works when it worked when it was gin and let's be high ABV, you know, let's do Navy Strix gin that still tastes good because we need that for cocktails. That kind of stuff is fantastic. But a lot of the stuff, you know, I think people saw that Ancho Reyes was really successful because it did something really unique. And then everyone in the market is like, well, I'm hibiscus. Well, I'm coffee. Well, I'm this. Well, I'm that. And some are great, but it's not the way to go, I wouldn't say. It's like you don't want to set out being in the cocktailer's arsenal. You're not doing it right. People should be able to enjoy it on their porch with an ice cube, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It feels like many spirits all over the world start off like Martin's family, you know, in great grandma's, you know, kitchen. Yeah. And then somehow becomes the cultural spirit of the place, and it starts off you're drinking it after dinner, or drinking it on its own at a holiday time, and then it somehow migrates into something else like a cocktail of some sort. And that's probably true of most spirits from that are from a place, from a specific part of the world. Right.
Yeah, and I think this is what sets this. We'll just become an ad now for Geyer Spirits, right? He's a part.
I'll take it.
I didn't know I'm not paid by Martin, and I don't know Martin. But I'll just say that, you know, coming on here and hearing that this is his grandmother's recipe. I mean, it's really quite rare in liquor these days, especially in the United States, which has gotten pretty cynical, and everybody's doing everything backwards, where they find some money, and then they find a brand that they want, and then they find a look, and then they find an artist, and they find, you know, they're Franken businesses. They're Franken. And, you know, you cannot replace having like sense memory from childhood drinking Glug. I mean, you just can't. I have some, you know,
drinking Glug?
Well, you know, yeah. Probably. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Drinking, yeah, right.
Yeah.
You can get arrested for that now.
Yeah.
Now.
They start you off with a non-alcoholic Glug exists. Then you have light alcoholic. Then you have medium alcoholic. And you have high alcoholic.
Training.
This is your new business model.
They actually rate them on the alcohol.
It's a farm club, farm system.
It's like weightlifting. You start with the 5-pound weight, you work to the 10-pound weight. Next thing you know, you're like in the Olympics as a powerlifter.
It's the childhood medicinal purposes only. Do you have a cold?
I hope.
Yes, I do.
I hope that after this this session, you'll go back and make a Kinder Glug.
Oh, that's funny. Oh, Kinder Glug. Don't get him started. He'll be selling to Montessori's before you know.
I have one across the street from my house. If
you want there you go.
Gotta hook them early, right?
Oh, Mom, I need a juice box. Mom, I need another juice box. Get me a juice box, Mom.
First, I hook the moms, then you get the kids.
You're going to be pushing out Sunny D as a box pretty soon. I can see Glug everywhere.
Sunny Glug.
Sunny Glug.
Well, I'm sure there's a version of Glug ever all over the world, right? In most, especially in Scandinavia, but
mostly European countries. Yeah,
yeah.
France had the Vinshaw, Germany had Glühwein, England has mulled wine, Finland has Glögi, Norway Glögi. Has Glug, but it's spelled different. Yeah, so you know they all have the different versions.
Those Finns.
Yeah. Those Finns.
If you want to win, get a Finn. Right. Oh, that's racing. I'm sorry.
This is
what was Finland's cocktail scene like? Mostly vodka?
Yeah, I don't know, actually. I assume, yeah, it's sit down and get blind drunk as quickly as possible.
Sorry if I offend any Finns out there.
No, me too. Yeah, I actually have a few Finnish
cards and letters. Cards and letters, not the booze dancing.
It really, yeah.
It wasn't me.
The closer you get to the Russian orbit, the more the drinking style is to, you know, put a really cold bottle on the table, put out the liver and some blueberries, and go for it, you know?
Yeah, there's actually a very Nordic Swedish cocktail. It's called Wolf Paw.
Yeah.
And it's essentially a glass of vodka with one lingonberry in it.
That's not a cocktail.
And no wolves were harmed in the making of that cocktail?
No wolves came to harm.
Isn't it weird that it feels like Russia, which is a huge, huge country, they're only known, maybe we just don't know enough, but it's just vodka, right?
Yeah.
We don't know about some other kind of interesting spirit that comes from Russia. I'm sure there are, but they probably have their own version of Glug and, you know, but you don't hear about those kinds of things. Yeah. Russia is vodka.
Yeah. Right. And a lot of it.
No, but it's kind of funny. Just going back to talking about making booze for cocktails or not, like when I, as I said, when I brought out the Glug, right, I had no intention of that ever being consumed in any other way than warm by Swedish contingency, right? So the first time somebody even suggested tasting it not heated up, I almost fell backwards. I'm like, I mean, you can't do that. This is a Glug.
How dare you?
And then they started making cocktails with it. I'm like, what is this? And so clearly this is a very esoteric type of spirit, right? So the bars that picked it up in the beginning, they were all like these really craft cocktail bars that wanted to explore and push the envelope a little bit. So I really got a crash course in flavors. And that's why I got intrigued with all the other spirits that I'm making that's up behind me. Because, I mean, that really launched me into this. I mean, I don't come from spirits, right? Yes, we had a family recipe, but we never had it as a business. We just cooked it for Christmases and drank it with family. Yeah, you know, right. And all of a sudden I'm like, this whole new world of flavors is just opening up. And it's just been an amazing journey, really. They're like, and then, you know, you do a homemade Amaro apricot cocktail with sea salt on it. You know, it's like, well.
Do you have other things on the drawing boards?
Right now, I actually am holding off because we just released the Amaro, like it's a couple of months ago, and we're just building inventory at this point. That's because we're so small, you know, the batches are, we're talking maybe 1200 bottles at a time. So
wow. And when he says we, he means me.
Yeah.
Let's not forget that.
So from
it's always the royal we.
So 1200 bottles per batch.
Yeah.
Do you see a difference between batch to batch?
No.
They're pretty consistent.
Very consistent. I mean, it doesn't matter how many, you know, pounds of botanicals I measure out. I still measure it out to the tenth of a gram. I mean, I follow the process exactly, right? So
that's interesting.
And it's scalable, I guess. So, I mean, you know, the proportions stay the same.
Yes. From this on, size on out, yes. In the beginning, when you start doing it on a couple of bottles and you do macerations and then you move on to distillations and then you scale it from, you know, a gallon to 500 gallon, that makes a difference. But at this level, it's linear, mostly linear, I should say. There's a few ingredients that you might want to adjust a little bit that has strong flavors. Yeah. Clove being one of them, right?
Do you find it difficult to get consistency with the ingredients, like the botanicals and all that kind of stuff? Or
not really. I mean, we're blessed here in California to have access. We have this huge farmer's market that's for restaurants that's right in South San Francisco, right? So all the fresh botanicals are always there. It's always the same vendor. And all the dried botanicals, I get it from the same store that has the same source. So so far I have not had an issue with variations.
Okay, that's good.
That Levantine gin from Milk and Honey is from a botanicals that are from a very old farmer's market in Tel Aviv. And it's been around forever. Folks come from all over to get the herbs and spices all over. It's amazing. Ange and I reviewed that a while back.
That's very good.
We really liked it in cocktails. On its own.
No, it was good on its own.
Yeah, I liked it in the gin and tonic that we had too, didn't I?
I thought it kind of disappeared in the gin and tonic.
You know, our pal, was it
Battle Tal? On the Hosts?
Our pal Tal even said, "This is a gin made for whiskey drinkers."
Yeah, he did say that.
Yeah. So, and I agree. I think it kind of gets lost in a gin and tonic. You know, maybe it's more for like a citrusy kind of drink, or maybe
you drink it straight. Yeah.
Or like a Collins or something like that.
It's interesting how gin has become this thing.
Or
right?
This,
yeah.
Right. Yeah,
yeah.
Gin has become this thing on its own, much like these liqueurs. Gin is almost like a liqueur, right? In a lot of ways, because you've got all these flavors going on and everyone can make it whatever way they want to make it, depending on where they are. No two gins are exactly the same, aside from the big brands, which are kind of the same. But after that, it's very regional, aside from the juniper, which is kind of in, you know, part of the DNA.
That's what makes it a gin, right?
Right. But after that, it doesn't
matter. Mine.
Yeah. But after that, it doesn't matter. You can do whatever you want. You know, from the botanist with their whatever 20-something botanicals from Isla to wherever.
Whatever they're doing in Mahon
in Spain or in Levantine gin. It feels almost like a regional liqueur in a lot of ways.
It's fun.
Minus the sherbet.
Certainly put their stamp on it.
Oh, yeah. Totally. Yep.
Our good friend with his owl.
Oh, yes. Mm. Yes. There's a gentleman in, is he in Scotland?
He's in Scotland, right?
Scotland. He's in Scotland.
He's in Scotland. Yeah, outside of Edinburgh.
Hamish.
Right?
Hamish. Yeah.
Yeah, Hamish. He's got a, what's his, company's called?
Well, it's the herbal gins in the United States, and it's the botanical gin in England, I think. Everywhere else?
Yeah. And he lives on a large plot, large, basically a farm where he's growing everything. He grows all kinds of things. And he's taking all of these things and making gin.
Yeah.
And it's roses, it's flower, all kinds of flowers, all kinds of things.
The only thing he didn't have was the juniper.
Right.
He was bringing that in because that hasn't grown enough that he has that yet. But all the other botanicals are on his farm. And it's amazing to taste what he rolls out there because it's so different. Even though it's gin, it's just different.
And like Mike said, this guy, Hamish, is crazy. Not crazy. Good crazy. He's got a pet owl. And the owl just flies around in his, you know, house.
I think the word is eccentric.
Maybe eccentric, yes. And also part of the Impex.
I'm going to do a cool event with him, and I haven't met him yet.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, my God. You guys together would be crazy. Yeah.
I would say he's beyond eccentric.
He's bordering on
quite mad. Mad, I tell you.
You know, you'll get along with him, Martin, because his Wi-Fi is not very good.
You know what's interesting? And aren't you right outside of Silicon Valley?
Yeah, Martin.
I am, and I restarted the router right before this, and I have cable.
Can't you have Tim Cook come over? Larry Ellison.
I'll give him a call after this. Yeah.
Yeah. Call those guys and bring them over, and you know,
make him a cocktail. I'll have him fix everything for you.
Yeah.
Well, no, wait. Let him fix everything, then give him a cocktail.
I gotta say this last cocktail, I think, was my favorite. I think this is my favorite cocktail.
The third one.
The third one.
Yeah, you know, really good. They are both really. They're really all really good. The third one, though, just has it mellows really nice over ice.
Yeah.
Like as the ice melts, it just gets a really nice mellowness to it.
I love
the. It's also the most complex cocktail that has the most things going into it, right? It has, and especially if you, I mean, I know not all of you use the chocolate bitters, but that gives a depth to it. But the Amaro starts off with a lot of botanicals, a lot of botanicals in the gin. Apricot is a really nice addition to it. Becomes a little more fruity.
I love it. I mean, I'm making my way through my little sample bottle of Amaro here.
I think I need to hook you up with a new bottle, huh?
I just keep adding a little bit to the cocktail.
I can see Andre going crazy trying to come up with something wacky with that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's been a long week, so a little extra Amaro never hurts anybody, right?
Absolutely. It's medicinal, for God's sake.
Exactly.
And like I said, it's not your grandfather's Amaro. It's Martin's Amaro. It's probably hard to say. It's not anise forward, right? It's not
that
bitter forward flavor that I
There's
don't
a
like.
A little bit of bitterness on the back, but not a lot. Just enough to say I'm an Amaro. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it's extremely approachable.
So again, yeah. I learned by my mistakes, right? When I did the Fernet,
I'm glad someone does. We don't.
It came out after diluting it, looking like swamp water green, right? Oh, and it's wow. not very good looking. So unfortunately, that one had to have caramel coloring in it because I couldn't change the recipe at that point. We had already distilled it, made everything, and it was just when we were diluting it down, it came out to be the wrong color. We're like, oh crud! I can't put that on the shelf. Don't say crud. It has caramel coloring in it. So when I made the Amaro, I made sure that I started with a bittering component that gives a lot of color. So I started with rhubarb roots. So all this coloring is actually really natural coloring, and rhubarb root is one big bittering component.
So this is 38% ABV. Uh-huh. What are standard? What are most Amaros? Are they in the same number?
Anything from really, I've seen them sub 20s, even up to mid 30s, right?
Yeah, this seemed high, so which it's not a bad thing. It just seemed different. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe that's part of it.
It's nice because I find a lot of them, some of my favorite Amaros are really low ABV, but then when you open it, you're basically dealing with a vermouth and you end up sticking in the refrigerator and yeah. You know, you kind of have to have a couple big, you're like, I hope I have a couple big dinner parties now that I've popped this open.
Yeah. That's right. Let's see, what's the oven cellar? That's 29%, for example.
Yeah.
When I'm drinking whiskey, I like take my Glencairns and leave them out overnight and then smell them in the morning. I'm curious how these are going to be in the morning.
That's only because he's lazy and he hopes someone washes them in the middle of the night.
I hope my wife puts them in the dishwasher, but
it never happens.
He says these things. Really. See, he gives you a nice, good story just to mask the laziness.
I do the same thing with my wine glasses.
I actually never leave anything
in the glass in the evening, unfortunately. It's always empty by the time I go to bed.
But there's always there's always something there.
A little residue.
And the orange actually is changing with air too.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
It's oxidizing as you speak.
It is oxidizing. Well, and the glug is just
actually, you know, what it is much more now that you say it, there's like a little tiny bit of my glass, and it is much more fragrant now.
I want to play with a glug and put it in different things. I want to put it in tea.
Yeah, a tea would be good with it.
Yeah, actually a Darjeeling tea cocktail made with it a while back.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Yeah.
So what next? You're distributed by, who is it?
JVS.
JVS. And how many states are you in then?
Well, JVS is the California distributor, Impex is the importer for JVS. So I'm with Impex, and they're rolling me out in multiple states across the U.S.
Good deal.
So, you may need to hire some people.
Yeah, you may need an employee or something.
Hey, I'm going to start by paying myself one of these days.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So I got a question for you guys. So now we're back kind of being social and all and making cocktails for people. If you could have one great dinner and invite three famous people, who would they be? And make cocktails for them.
Alive? People that are alive?
I don't care. Make a dead person.
We could reanimate them. You know, I could probably get to a biology. I can get us some brains. We could reanimate some folks. We could just do a whole Frankenstein thing.
Calm down there, Abby Normal.
Come on. Walk this way.
Yeah, what do you think, Andre? What do you think, Andre? Who'd you invite?
Oh, wow. I'd probably go for like Oscar Wilde and maybe Brando.
Brando?
Yeah. You can go Brando? Food fight, right?
That's going to get crazy. Wild, great together.
That's going to get a little crazy. Amazing.
I don't know. And then probably, one of the starlets from the past, I suppose. I got to throw somebody in there.
Well, who?
Name one. Rita Hayworth.
Hedy Lamarr.
Rita Hayworth. Any of them, really. That era. Have a little cocktail party.
Yeah, keep away from Brando, though. Other side of the table. How about you, Martin?
You know, I'm really bad at these type of hypotheticals. You know, I could go all from like famous cocktail makers of the modern era to like Jesus Christ to
a drinker.
Yeah, big drink. Hey, he drinks wine.
He was a winemaker. He was a winemaker.
He can turn water into anything.
All the California stuff.
That's right.
I don't really know. I don't have a drink, to be honest. So I'm like, I am really bad at those kind of things.
Well, I'm just glad that we can think about having people over again and,
yeah,
and kind of socializing.
So wait, you've posed the question. So who, you obviously have some people in mind. What do you got, Aaron?
Yeah. There you go. Well,
hard for me not to say Groucho Marx, of course, right?
Oh, yeah.
Groucho is my spirit warrior.
Spirit animal.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I don't know. Bill Murray would be kind of fun.
Bill Murray would be fun.
Oh, Bill Murray is a classic, actually.
And maybe Bill with Sigourney Weaver at the same table.
Whoa. That
would be fun. Hell,
there you go. Yeah.
That would be interesting.
Here's my three.
Groucho Marx, you're going to have a crazy time, too. I'll send Brando over afterwards.
I didn't know that Bill Murray got arrested for drunk driving a golf cart downtown Stockholm.
Oh, what?
Money. What?
Oh, Bill. Oh, Bill.
A couple of years ago now.
He's talking about next week.
I think he was in a robe.
I can't tell if Mike is frozen. No, Mike's not frozen. No, Mike, you're muted.
You're muted, Mike. We have a friend who's a cocktail or a whiskey writer in New York, Susanna Skyver Barton, formerly from Whiskey Advocate. And yeah, I believe, do you know Martin? She was at a bar in Brooklyn. It was a few years ago when Bill Murray came in and just kind of got behind the bar and started pouring.
Yeah, his son was bartending or owned part of a bar in Brooklyn.
Something like that. Yeah. He just came in and started, you know, I believe that story, right, Ange? Wasn't that?
Yeah,
that Susanna right. was there. And yes. Crazy Bill was like, you know, sloshing together drinks that weren't really well crafted. They were the unwell crafted.
Who cares?
Imagine. I can have world's worst cocktail by Bill Murray.
Untoted whiskey.
That's right. Hey, gin, whatever. Whiskey, whatever. We don't have whiskey.
Pour you a glass of like old granddad and say, hey, here's a Manhattan for you.
Suntory fun time.
Mike, who's your three, Mike?
My three? Oh, I don't know.
You don't know? Come on.
You got to get a guy who's like a real drinker. So you get like FDR.
Winston Churchill.
FDR.
FDR or Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah,
those guys were known to throw them back.
Oh, uh-huh. Teddy Roosevelt would be fun to have dinner with.
Maybe fun. Just telling stories. You got to go with like a John Barrymore, one of those old-time Hollywood guys. Just known for being drunks, which not in a bad way. You know, they're just fun.
Pretty much grab anybody pre-World War II Hollywood, and you'll have really good lunch.
I got to go with Andres. You know, you got to get a little eye candy. You got to get an old starlet. So, sure. Hedy Lamarr, anyone, Dorothy Lamour, anybody would answer the phone. Anybody at all. Why not?
That's funny.
We had, we did a conversation with, what's our rum guy? What's our rum?
Oh,
our,
Mitch and Don?
Mitch, what's Mitch's
last name? Mitch Wilson and Don Davies.
Yeah, from, also a Impex. Yep. Yes. The Impex family.
Oh, the Black Top guys?
The Black Top guys. And he had this long story about how Churchill wasn't actually a big drinker, right? Yeah. It was all for show.
That's good show.
Never finished,
never finished a drink, right.
They always say that Dean wasn't actually drunk, although I think he actually was drunk.
the Dean Martin thing is kind of...
He had apple juice on the stage. He might have had drinks other times, but apple juice on the stage.
And Sinatra was drinking Jack Daniels, but... Yeah. Was he really? And then Jack Daniels went and pushed out a Sinatra
version.
Version with the JD on it or something, right?
Yeah.
Because that's what Jack.
Sinatra would be a fun guy, though. That could be.
Sinatra would be really fun.
Yeah.
Oh, totally.
Angela, who are your three?
Well, my three, I think they got to be great storytellers or just people that I've heard in interviews. So I like Clooney, Cranston, and Kate Winslet.
Good ones.
I've heard them in interviews, and they are fantastic. I think they would be great guests. I think they'd be fun. They could just run the show, just tell stories, and just have
Clooney,
a good time.
Clooney would bring his tequila, and Cranston would bring his mezcal. Right, and Kate Winslet
doesn't need to bring anything.
She'd bring a hoagie. She
could bring some hoagies from Wawa.
That's right. She could bring her Philly stuff. Yeah, yeah.
And some vape pens, and we're all good.
The thing that people don't get with Clooney is his ties to old Hollywood.
Yeah.
Right.
Because his aunt was Rosemary Clooney. Clooney, and
right.
She was married to Jose Ferrer.
Yeah. That's right.
And they were friends with Bob Hope and all that. And you know, he hung out with all these people as like kids, where he was like, oh, I know everybody.
And he's a Cincinnati guy. Yeah. He grew up because his dad was a newscaster in Cincinnati. Yeah.
Cincinnati, Kentucky. Okay.
Yeah. He grew up in Kentucky, right?
Yeah.
Oh, Kentucky. Yeah, on the border.
Northern Kentucky, yeah.
Right.
He should be making a whiskey then.
That'll be next.
Well, he can now because he sold that, what's it called, Casamigos?
Yeah, but now he's got that money to make a whiskey.
$4 trillion right. or something like that?
Yeah. Something like that.
I think it was just a billion, but, you know, who's counting?
Whatever.
Just a billion.
Martin, you should only be so lucky.
No kidding.
What's a billion?
You know who says just a billion? Billionaires.
Yeah. That's so true.
Trillionaires.
Best commas.
Damn it. Hate them. Hate them.
Did you guys ever watch the finale of the show?
What's that?
Silicon Valley.
Oh, yeah. We love Silicon Valley.
Oh, yeah. I love that show.
Tres Comas, right?
See.
That's right.
Oh, the Tres Comas Club. Yeah.
Tres Comas.
That's fun.
Oh, that's tequila.
I just love this Amaro. The smell
is all
so
very
good.
Really well done. Good.
Well, guys, this has been really fun.
Fantastic. Cheers.
Martin, this was really great. We wish you much luck with all your brands and Yair Spirits. Andre. Yeah. We wish you luck out on the road. Getting out
there
with
you
your books.
Really
with
fun.
With your many books.
Out with everybody. Really fun.
I look forward to exploring the Gotham City cocktails.
And I got to say, one that I have here too is
Booze and Vinyl, baby.
Booze and Vinyl.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, FYI, Aaron, just so you know, I paid a visit to Andre last night, and man is 100. He's 1,000% on brand.
Oh, I love it.
Everywhere. There was a full, like, you know, turntable setup, vinyl records, the whole kit, man.
That's awesome. Andre, how many records do you have?
Only a few hundred now. I've culled over the years. You know, I would fill the house with them, but, you know, I have a girlfriend and she wants some space left.
Yeah, they are space.
I know, it's terrible. I have these hobbies that are the analog hobbies that just pack the house. You know, I also love book. I'm a writer, so. One room's books, one room's booze, one room's vinyl, and you know, there's no place left. But I love vinyl. But this was really fantastic, Martin. I really like your products. I don't think I'd run into them before, so this was really exciting to try this stuff.
Martin,
that's very cool. Yeah, it was awesome meeting you as well. I mean, it was a very enjoyable evening.
Martin, are you on the East Coast yet? Can we find bottles on the East Coast?
I think so. I don't fully have a grasp of exactly everything where I'm at. I'm actually going to have a connection call with Chris in the next couple of days.
Mr. Udi, yes.
But I know I'm still with Martinetti for the Northeast area. So kind of Massachusetts up north. I know I'm represented. I think New York is still where I'm struggling to have something. So we'll see. I'm hoping to get an update on that pretty soon.
Yeah, it'll happen as things open up here.
We are fans, that's for sure. We are fans. So, guys, we cannot thank you enough for coming on and spending a little bit of your Friday night.
Thank you for having us. Me again.
We wish you luck with your spirits, Martin, and we wish you, Andre, with so much luck with all your books that are coming out.
Thanks
and out
so much.
On the shelves at Amazon and wherever you can find a good book on your your stores.
On it goes.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, don't go away, guys. Hold on a sec.
Hang around the green room for a little bit. We're just going to close things out.
Okay.
All right. Cheers, gents. Hold on one sec. Enjoy the lutefisk. That was fun, man.
Wow, that was fun.
That was delicious. I think that.
I'm just amazed that I like an Amaro. I never really liked Amaros. And I think because of the anise thing has always been kind of, that's not my wheelhouse.
The one note off-putting,
I'm not a black licorice guy.
I love black licorice.
I'm not a big fennel guy.
I love fennel.
And this is really great because it's not fennel anise forward.
Yeah. It's fun. It's fun stuff. I like it. I like do we have a favorite of the cocktails? It's a tough call. I think I like the first and the third.
I like the third one the best.
Yeah, that was really, really good.
I like the first and the second one best. I'm not sure about the third.
I think the first one I used instead of using the Penderin, I used the Kleinleash 10. Oh, I think you had sent this over here, the Signatory bottle.
Yeah.
I think it was too high in ABV.
Okay.
That can do it.
So I think that might have been why I didn't like that cocktail as much.
I think
I thought the second one was better than the first because I think I ruined the first, and I really liked the last one.
Yeah, I think I liked the first better. The third one, I think the beat that I used the beat from Boredom Spirits was maybe a little bit too much. Not sure.
We were using the that apricot that Andre had sent along.
That's really, really
good. And that was just, it was a good blend with that. And then I think I picked the right gin. I used that the Matsui gin.
Yeah.
Also from JVS. And, you know, I think it really worked out.
Yeah. And we should mention again, our friends at Impex JVS, Impex Beverages, and thank you again for turning us on to Martin and sending us some samples. Really good stuff, and we are.
And they really comb the globe for quality cocktails and ingredients and quality standalone ingredients, and they keep finding stuff that I don't know people would find on their own.
You know, and a while back, Ange, you and I, and my wife, we did the Falernum.
We did the Falernum, and we did the Fernet.
And the Fernet, that's right. Yeah.
Both delicious stuff, delicious.
We enjoyed that.
Really good.
And I've used both of those, not the Fernet, the Falernum, I've actually used as a sweetener instead of simple syrup in a couple cocktails.
Nice.
Yeah.
I could see that working really well.
Yeah. You don't like too much sugar. And that's interesting that what Martin was saying, you know, it's a balance of, you don't want to get too far off on the sugar content. You got to have some though. And if it gets that happy point, you really can use it as a substitute in other drinks for simple syrup and vermouth.
Simple syrup where you don't want so much sugar and you want the flavor and not just the sugar, because it's got enough sweetness, but then it brings something else to the equation.
Wow, that was really fun. Really fun.
Cool.
Can't think of that enough. We got some credits. Run them.
Yeah, you want to close this thing out?
Yeah. Shut down. We're done. So
fun. We thank everyone for watching Booze Dancing TV. Thanks for joining us tonight. Have a great, great, great summer. We'll be back with something fun in a few weeks, probably.
Or cool. Not. All right, man. Let's roll these credits.
We're not.
We're not. Oh, hush. We'll be right back.